From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's the home edition. You may know my guests from, oh, I don't know, Excalibur or Christopher Columbus, or you might know him as Tom Reagan, or you might know him as Dr. Paul Weston from In Treatment. You definitely know him from somewhere. My guest is Gabriel Byrne. His memoir, his book, which I've had the greatest time reading, is called Walking with Ghosts. And I'm talking to the very talented Gabriel Byrne. Gabriel, so good to have you here. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Elvis, for inviting me.
As I was telling you before we got started, the book has really a lyric quality, and there's so much that in the reading of the book, you, first of all, you move back and forward in time, and there's a line from an old Russian novel where I think maybe it's Oblomov, where time is described like as being like a breeze blowing past your face. And the way you move back and forth in time feels like that to me.
Yes, well, one of the things I wanted to experiment with, I suppose, was the notion of time, because I was trying to look back over the events of my life and not just recount the events themselves, but to deal with the idea of the past and time and how that affects the present. The book in the opening page of it describes what my mother used to say to me, which is a line from Percy B. Shelley, the romantic English poet of the 19th century. He said, you know, that regret not the past, fear not the future. And I tried to use that as a dictum to live my own life by, but also I used it as a kind of a device to look at the events of the past and the people of the past, and indeed the landscapes of the past, which are for the most part gone. There's nobody in the book that's still alive. So, you know, everybody whose story is recounted there is in their own way a ghost. But the idea that we walk ourselves accompanied by the ghosts of the past is something that's deep in the Native American tradition. And that's where I got the idea for the book, is to talk about the ghosts of the people who walk with us, not just that, but also the events and the failures and the successes that also accompany, the regrets, the failures, the triumphs, all the things of the past life that walk with us in the forms of ghosts. And of course, that's all wrapped up in the capsule of time.
Well, also, we should say in the opening section you're talking about, you start off by talking about a joke book that you got as a kid where you learned how to tell jokes. And I don't know if you remember the joke from that first page, but it actually made me laugh out loud because I hadn't heard it since I was a kid. Do you remember the joke?
Yeah. Well, I remember the book. And when you're young and you're trying to forge an identity, I think, and you don't have anybody to direct you in any particular way, you think, oh, that would be a good thing. Take a book out of the library of the world's thousand great jokes. Take it up to the Phoenix Park in Dublin on a summer afternoon and try to learn all the jokes in the book. And the only one I remember, as is the way often with jokes, you hear them and you think, God, I must remember that one. And of course, you forget it immediately. But the only one I do remember is the one in the book. Like you, it still makes me laugh because it's utterly ridiculous. Two cannibals are eating a clown. One turns to the other and says, does this taste funny to you? That's the joke. I don't know. I honestly still don't know what's funny about that. But I think it's the image of two guys with a clown, you know, like eating their way through a clown like they would through a corn thing. And they both look at each other in mid-chew and, you know, I don't know. It's when you try to visualize it that it becomes funnier, I think.
It's a kind of a perfect joke. And also in the context of the book, it works in so many ways because it sets into motion that thing where you deal with your anxiety about meeting new people. And if you're learning jokes, it's a way to break the ice with people. It's also a performative thing, and there's so much kind of surrealism in your book. kind of about cultures sort of clashing and the idea of Candles eating a clown, you wonder how a clown would get there. I mean, it's funny that joke stuck with you for me because it evokes so many things that we read, that we see in the book so often. You keep kind of going back to that, that anxiety of trying to connect with people. And also, you have an eye for the absurd as well. So I think all these things that the book is to me are kind of reflected in that joke.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of that. And of course, it is an interesting question to ask why you remember certain, not just jokes, but why you remember certain events and why you remember a particular phrase or what seems like an absolutely mundane moment. You remember that. And of course, it's a good question to ask, like, why do I remember that? What does that say about me that that's the joke, you know, I remembered? And it is surreal, and surrealism, I suppose, the word means that it exists just below the level of what we call reality. And reality has always been, for me, at least I think of it, has been something very unreliable and very, very subjective. And any policeman will tell you if a man falls off his bicycle and seven people see it, there'll be seven different stories about it. And so how reality is retold and remembered is a very interesting thing to me.
It's the treatment we talked to Gabriel Byrne about his memoir, Walking with Ghosts. There are so many of the anecdotes that you relate in the book that make me think of characters. When you're in school and talking about what original sin is, or the nun is telling you that, I just found myself thinking about that kind of doer quality of Tom Regan in Miller's Crossing and how finally, for me, he seems to be beset with original sin, this thing he can't shake. But in reading a number of those stories, characters of yours came to mind for me, and or characters you played. And I immediately after I read the book and went back and rewatched some of these things, I thought, yeah, Tom Regan is almost an Old Testament figure who's carrying original sin with him and he can't shake it.
Well, that's an interesting connection. The idea of original sin is something that is something I would say, without trying to sound pedantic, it traps the soul from developing. If you're told that a sin that was committed by Adam and Eve, who may or may not have been real, it's very unlikely that they were real, but that the sin that they committed is something that you can never rub off your own soul. So you carry this with you in your life. I'm not saying that I carry it in my life, but the idea behind it is to make you beholden to this event that happened way, way, way before you were born that you can never free yourself of. And what was the sin? The sin was that God gave a beautiful garden to Adam and Eve and told them, you can have everything in this garden, but you can't eat that apple over there. Now, it says something that that they were curious about the apple. If he had said, oh, no, you can't eat that mango over there, they probably would have had the same curiosity about that. But it happened to be an apple. And because the woman is the temptress in the story or the myth, she's the one who says to Adam, go over and take a bite out of it. And he says, no, we can't do that. God will be really angry. And she takes the bite out of it. And it's that bite that condemns mankind to suffering. So the suffering of mankind is caused by a woman. And the original sin that you carry in your life in the form of guilt, a guilt that you never asked for, did nothing to earn, carries you.
Yes, it's exactly. You're right. It's inherited misery. And that idea, because a lot of this, for example, with Tom Regan is never explained. And just the relation of that anecdote, you know what I mean? Does that make sense to you that I would connect that to that character?
Yes, because I think that deep down inside Tom Regan is this unhappiness about the restlessness of himself and who he is. And I think that's a common trait among noir characters who stand in for, in a way, the crippled, suffering characters who feel that they owe a debt to something that they've never even experienced themselves. It's a peculiar darkness in the heart.
But again, so much of the book for me is interesting because it's about you finding ways to deal with your own anxiety. I laughed out loud and was kind of horrified by you relating the stories about the making of Excalibur, where at one point you talk about, because the line stuck with me, I found it difficult to master the technique of acting for the film camera. And you basically tell why, because you didn't quite understand something going on in Excalibur. And John Borman, the director, said, just fake it for the camera.
Yeah. I mean, you see, because I'd never gone to drama school, so I didn't know anything about the techniques of camera. I didn't know there was such a thing as a long shot, a mid shot, and a close-up, and that a scene incorporates all those shots, and it takes 2 or 3 days to do them, or at least in those days, it did. And there was a scene where myself and another actor were way, 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 way back, barely seen. We were just literally background to the action that was going on. And I remember slogging through the mud in a real suit of armor, giving it everything. And the actor who was with me said to me, Jesus Christ, will you stop acting? They can't see us. And so when we, you know, when we got to the close-ups, we did 2 takes, and I said, "Oh, that's great. That's no. You have to go up on top of this ladder because they want to do a shot of you on the ladder." And I said, "But I've just been on a horse. How can I be on a ladder?" And he says, "Not you on the ladder. We want that height so that we can get the camera up to show your face." And similarly, when I came down to do the love scene where the character that I played, who's this crazed kind of mythical warlord, takes the wife of the Duke of Cornwall by force. We did a wide shot against the fire, again in a real suit of armor. And the sweat was pouring off me for the wide shots. And then they took her out and they put in a pink cushion and nobody said anything to me. And they just said, action. And I looked at John Borman and I said, where is she? He said, just hump the cushion. This is a close-up. And so I found myself in a full suit of armor, literally humping a pink cushion. I thought, Jesus Christ, this movie business is really hard to understand. But I know that when the film was shown in Dublin, where I wasn't at the premiere, the fact that I was able to do the business and reach full Congress in a complete suit of armor with no obvious method of egress in this awful costume got a round of applause.
I mean, that's what's one of the things that's just so wonderful about the book is you're being able to relate your state of anxiety and also in just addressing the absurdity of what's going on around you and being in a heightened situation like making your first movie, a situation like doing an Arthurian myth table, fable with John Borman, or just walking down the street and seeing sort of the local man about town wearing his hairpiece and you're wondering if it was some of the clippings from the barbershop that ended up on his head.
Yeah, this was a barber who unfortunately went bald in his early 20s. And now when we were customers of his, he must have been in middle age. But the entire village or town colluded in the reality that he didn't have a wig. So nobody ever mentioned it to him. So he was convinced that nobody knew. But we all knew he had a wig. So he'd have different wigs for different occasions. And I remember calling to his house one day and he had a wig where he was, it was a wig for just getting out of the shower wig where it was all kind of wet. And he said, oh, Jesus, I'm just getting in the shower. Come in and sit down in the sitting room. And then he'd have a formal one and a kind of a tossed one where he'd say, geez, that's an awful rough day out there today. And people would say, yeah, it is rough. But anyway, he used to cut the hair and his apprentice, who was a guy called Jerry, would sweep up the hair that fell on the floor and they'd give it to these places where they'd make wigs for sick people, you know, people who had diseases, and they make them like hair pieces and so forth. And one day I looked at him and I thought, maybe he's keeping that hair, the hair clippings for himself. And those wigs are made out of my hair. He could be wearing my hair.
And on that hirsute story, we'll take a break. My guest is Gabriel Byrne. His terrific memoir is called Walking with Ghosts. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Gabriel Byrne, actor and now author, Gabriel Byrne. His memoir is Walking with Ghosts. And again, just in reading the book, Gabriel, there are just so many times I was struck by how these things that you encountered reflected characters you played. Like as you're talking about meeting the old Prussian patriot who would become an extra, he's telling you his World War II stories. I could see in that instance, it's almost like watching, you know, Paul from In Treatment and dealing with somebody and shaping that story.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I like to get to know people's stories. Because we were shooting in a very unusual place, you had the irony of a Russian soldier being dressed as a German who had fought the Germans in the Second World War. And he told me the story of how he was recruited towards the end of the war to fight with the partisans against the Germans. And before he left his house in the valley, he took a photograph of his wife with him to put in his wallet. And every night before he would go to sleep, he'd look at the photograph and really communicate with the photograph because he missed his wife so much. He lost track of time. And he also lost the photograph of his wife. And every night before he would go to sleep, he'd have to imagine the face of his wife. When the war was over, he came back and he found his way. He, as I said, he'd lost all sense of time. He found his way back to the valley that he was from. He came to it just as dawn was coming. He came down the side of the mountain and he saw his house. And he was afraid that his wife was no longer there. And he went to the window and he looked in and he saw his wife moving in the room. And he knocked on the window and she looked out at him. And he thought she was a ghost. And he thought he was dreaming. And that's what kind of summed up to me what a lot of the book is about. That sometimes we don't know the difference between when we're dreaming something or when we're actually imagining it, and sometimes whether we're actually living it. So to me, like an extra, somebody that you meet on a bus, even some guy who sits down beside you and you say to yourself, oh, Jesus, this guy's an awful bore. When's he going to shut up? And then you kind of tune into him and you realize he's actually telling you something kind of interesting, even if he's not telling it in a very interesting way. Because sometimes mundanity can be absolutely fascinating.
By the way, it's The Treatment. We're talking with the star of In Treatment, Gabriel Byrne. His book is Walking with Ghosts. In reading the book, I got to see how so many of the things you've done as an actor were shaped by things that happened in your life. And is that thing you say that your dad said to you as a kid that, you know, the most interesting acting you're going to see in performance is the theater of the street?
Yeah. Basically, what he was saying is that the theater is everywhere around you and that films are everywhere around you and that real characters are everywhere. And I suppose the link between Paul Weston and the narrator of this book is me is that a great therapist, I think, listens. A great therapist is a great listener. And it's a wonderful gift to somebody else to really listen to what they're saying. Because we all have stories. We all have incredible, extraordinary stories that we rarely get the chance to tell each other. And as a therapist, I suppose the guy in treatment didn't always know the answer, but he sometimes knew the right question to ask that would provoke somebody into telling the story that he could then listen to and draw conclusions from.
Yeah, there's that too, but it's also taking in detail, looking at body language, watching the tilt of the head. I mean, I'm struck by the way you so often describe skin in the book, and you talk about the knobby foot of the St. Patrick statue, or the texture of the skin on the nun's hands, or just a look on somebody's face. I mean, I can see you leaning in to pay attention to people, and as an actor, do these details just start landing with you right away, and it's clear. If when you pick up the book, people will be able to see that you're kind of a born storyteller.
Well, I grew up in a tradition, I suppose, of storytellers. If you sit down with your average Irish person and you say to them, what time is it? He could be still telling you the time a half an hour later. Because, you know, people talk about, you know, asking directions for people in Ireland. It's become a bit of a cliche where people would say, can you tell me how to get to such and such a place? And they'd say, well, I wouldn't start from here if I was you. Or I do remember myself when I was married to a Jewish girl and I brought her to Dublin. And I was trying to explain to her what Irish humor was as opposed to Jewish humor of New York, which is tends to be very quick and tends to be one-liners. You know, you think of, say, Fran Lebowitz or, you know, Jackie Mason or Woody Allen or one of those guys. Whereas Irish humor is often surreal and it doesn't know it's funny. And that's what makes it hilarious. For example, we were going to this place one night to a party in this house called the Prince of Wales Terrace. And we stopped in the middle of the town and there were two guys standing in the doorway of the bar and I rolled down the window and I said, lads, can you tell me, is Prince of Wales Terrace near here? And the two of them, you know, rolled off the side of the porchway and came over and looked in the window and like to see what was in the car and who was in there. And the one guy says, Prince of Wales Terrace, Prince of Wales Terrace. And you just know he had no idea where it was. Prince of Wales Terrace. Prince of Wales Terrace. Do you know where it is, Seamus? And Seamus says, Prince of Wales Terrace. And then he looks at me and he says, do you know whereabouts it is? Because if you know where it is, I can direct you to it. I said, if I knew where it was, why would I be asking you where it is? And so she said, I get it. That's what Irish humor is. It's like, it's illogical, it's surreal, and yet at the same time, it makes total sense. If I knew where it was, he could tell me how to get there. That there's a logic in that. But what's illogical and surreal about it is that I was asking him where it was, and he didn't know. But he was asking me where, you get the drift of it.
Yeah, no, that's why I mentioned that joke you start the book with, because it has in its own illogic, a kind of logic to it. Well, I guess the clown would taste funny if you were just being literal about it. And that's why that struck me, because again, like so much of the book, which is about sort of looking forward, paying attention to what's going on to you right now, describing something in sort of plaintive detail that because it's so odd, it's both funny and tragic at the same time. For me, there's so much of who you are as an actor in that joke that stuck with you for some obvious reason that you divined that it's part of who and what you are. Because I also find myself thinking so many lines that stuck with me from the book. And I guess in the writing of the book, you had a chance to really assess your life because at one point you wrote, I made several films about war. And I thought, oh my God, that's right, he has. I mean, even Miller's Crossing is about war. Even In Treatment's about war, kind of. I mean, so many of these things that you've been in are about sort of extreme states and trying to reflect on who and what you are as these things are happening around you.
Yeah, I suppose the connection between work and self is a very interesting one too, because I've come to believe that work is very different to the self. What we work at is not who we are. It's an extension, and sometimes not a terribly important extension, of who we are. And so, of course, yourself pours into your work and the work comes back into you to kind of to give you a sense of identity. But the truth about it is that work is just a thing that you do. Life is the thing that's important. And so what I was trying to do was, without mentioning anything in relation to acting or Hollywood or anything like films or anything like that, I wanted to construct all the things that went into the fact of my later life. What were the events and the people and the incidents that happened to me that determined the rest of my life? And we all have those stepping stones that get us from one bank of the river to the other.
But it's also, too, about understanding who you are in the context of these things that really feel heightened to you, but they could be, in retrospect, mundane. So I think about that great section where you talk about falling in love and being with your first serious girlfriend, and I just struck on the detail. I love Gene Pitney. I lied. Because it's a situation where everything's heightened, and it's something we've all gone through. But your ability to pick out detail, I mean, I guess what we want from actors is their observational skills, if they're any good at it, that they can find to breathe into the characters they played.
Yeah, I do think myself that the process of writing and the process of acting, I recounted in the book about the old actor who gives a transportive performance one night where he reaches a height where he can't even believe that he's ascended to that height of acting. And the people around him know it, and the audience knows it, and the people in the wings know it. And yet, when he's lying on the ground in a sweat, he gets up and he bows and he rushes off the stage through the stage workers and into his dressing room, where he slams the door in anger. And somebody goes down and knocks on the door and he barks, "Come in." And the person walks in and says, "I just want to say that that was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. It was just incredible." And the actor says, "I know." And the guy says, "Well, why are you so angry?" And he says, "Because I don't know how I did it." And I think that's the thing that actors especially feel. I've never met an actor who said, "Oh, I know where this comes from." The process is incomprehensible. Why one person should be good and another person should be not good, nobody's ever been able to figure out. You can go to all the drama schools you want, but it's not going to make you a good actor. It's something that comes down from somewhere and goes inside you. And I suppose the ancestor of the actor is the shaman in primitive society, the guy who went out and danced in front of the villagers and took all the trauma and the pain and the joy of the tribe into himself and expressed it. And I think that's the primitive form of what the actor is. But I think if you said to that shaman, "Why are you dancing? And why are you jumping around doing cartwheels and pretending to be crying and pretending to be laughing?" he wouldn't have an answer either. Whereas writing seems to me to be a more conscious effort at recording a different kind of detail.
I could really do this with you for much longer, but we're out of time. So I just say right now, thank you. And it's a terrific book. And I can't thank you enough for doing this, Gabriel. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, Elvis. Thank you so much indeed. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. My guest is Gabriel Byrne. His book is Walking with Ghosts. Our recording engineer at KCRW, who also mixes the show, is Kat Yore. It's edited by producer Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.